plan to spice up the NFL season was to add man-eating tigers to the game. We lost a lot of great players that day, and that was my bad. Now I'm bringing you the Caesars Sportsbook app. It's got live in-game betting, parlays, and Caesars rewards, people. It's even better than Tiger Ball.
Must be 18. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700.
Hi, I'm John Bearer, the host and lead researcher for Stories of Sacrifice, American POW-MIA podcast, and the U.S. POW-MIA Family Locating. A free forensic genealogy public service I provide to support POW-MIA families trying to get their loved one identified and brought home. First, I want to thank you, our listeners, for your interest in the Stories of Sacrifice podcast. Our goal with the podcast is to tell the world about the sacrifice these brave heroes gave for the freedoms we enjoy every day. They gave our country their last full measure. They give us their tomorrow for our freedom today. Second, we would like to raise public awareness that thousands of these heroes from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War have still not yet been found or returned to the United States, with many still buried as unknowns in our own national cemeteries. Their families still waiting for our government to disinter and identify them. So what can you do to support this important mission? First, if you are a relative of a missing in action service member, you can visit the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency website for more information about providing a family reference DNA sample. If you want more information, you can also contact me at john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Even if you're not related to an MIA, you can contact your members of Congress to request they allocate enough funding to support the POW-MIA mission and to change the DPAA policy to a DNA lead process and create additional public partnerships to disinter and process the remains for those that are buried as unknown. You can also help us in our mission by sharing these podcast stories with your friends, family, and consider sharing them on your own social media. We would also appreciate if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit www.storiesofsacrifice.org and leave us a review there. You can visit our affiliate links on our website where we will earn a small commission on your purchases at no extra cost to you. If you feel moved to do so, please visit our donation links on our website to help us continue this important mission. Just sharing these stories helps us greatly, and we cannot thank you enough for listening. Sit back and relax, and we hope you enjoy today's show. Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II American POW-MIAs in the Philippines. This is a production of the U.S. POW-MIA Family Locating. I'm your host and lead researcher, John Bearer. Over 75,000 service members are still listed as missing in action from World War II. Of those, over 30,000 are currently listed as active pursuit by the Defense POW-MIA Accounting Agency. Active pursuit meaning they could possibly be identified with the proper family reference sample DNA being on file with the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The process of donating DNA reference material is easy, painless, and free of charge. If you are the relative of a missing service member, you can contact the Service Casualty Office of the MIA for information on how to provide a DNA sample. The Service Casualty Office will mail to your home a DNA donor kit that contains a donor consent form, instruction form, 3 cheek swabs, and a shipping envelope. All you have to do is fill out the paperwork, rub the inside of your cheek with the swabs, place the swabs back into the containers, and affix the label. The collected samples are then placed in a pre-addressed and prepaid envelope and then mailed to the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab at Dover. That's it. It's a completely painless process. To get more information about your missing in action relative, you can visit our website, uspowmiafamilylocating.com, and we can help you to determine if your relative is currently listed on the DPAA active pursuit list and the next steps to help get them identified. Just visit our website or email john@uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. Please take a minute to subscribe to our podcast to help get these heroic stories out to the public. On today's Story of Sacrifice podcast, I want to welcome Mike Creel, who is the grandson of Sergeant Leonard James McNeil, who served as a tail gunner in the 881st Bombardment Squadron, 500th Bomb Group in the Pacific during World War II. Welcome, Mike. Thank you for joining us to tell us about your grandfather's sacrifice and the steps that you're taking to get him identified and brought home.
I'm doing very well, John. Thank you. Leonard James McNeil was born on Prince Edward Island, Canada, in 1917. He's the son of Willie and Margaret McNeil, M little C, big N, little E, I, L, L, McNeil. So he was born there on Prince Edward Island. He has a older brother and a older sister, Willie. Willie is the brother's name, and Melva is the sister's name. So he's born there in Canada. The family relocated to Boston, Massachusetts. Leonard got his high school diploma from Somerville High School near Boston, Mass. From there, he worked at J.J. Pierce Grocery, J.J. Pierce Grocers in the greater Boston area. And what they did at J.J. Pierce was they took grocery orders from around the community. The groceries would come in, be shipped in from all over the country. They would pack them on trucks and carts and things, and then they would be shipped out to the community for folks to run their businesses or their families, whatever the grocers went to. So after my grandfather graduated, worked at J.J. Pierce for a couple of years, subsequently, J.J. Pierce is currently owned by Kraft Food Company. So that's what it turned into ultimately. So from there, Leonard went to Orlando, Florida. He earned enough money working at J.J. Pierce, it appears. I don't have a lot of history on his life prior to the military records that I have, simply because Leonard's existence was basically withheld from his family. For reasons I'll explain here later on. So he makes enough money, buys himself a car, drives south, goes to Orlando, Florida. When he gets to Orlando, he winds up meeting my grandmother there, and he gets employment at a diner that she's working at, the Green Tree Cafe, I believe they called it. So he's working there. The two of them meet, fall in love. Early 1937, 1938, after their courtship, they go to, takes my grandmother, her name is Melba. He takes Melba to Somerville, Mass, introduces her to his parents. They make an announcement they're going to be married, and they are married in Somerville, Massachusetts in August of 1938. So they honeymoon back down the East Coast, get back into Orlando, Florida. They start their life as a married couple. They have three children. My mother was born in 1940. My oldest uncle was born earlier than that. And my youngest uncle, who is still alive today, was born in 1941. Life goes on there in Orlando, Florida, with this young family. Leonard is about 26 years old at the time he received his draft notice in 1943. So from their marriage and life and building this family, they now had three children. He has gainful employment. He's involved in the hospitality industry in Orlando, Florida. He's working at a place called the Ange Built, which is a hotel. and the tap room, the name is escaping me right now, that he's working at a tap room there in Orlando, Florida. Family life goes on. Of course, 1941, the U.S. enters into World War II. He's still doing his thing, working daily, doing his thing. 1943, receives his notice. He reported to Camp Blanding, Florida, for his induction.
So then he was drafted then, huh?
Yes, sir. He was drafted. Yeah, he was drafted at like I say, age 26, with three children and a career ahead of him and all this stuff. You know, I mean, he was doing his part here on the home front, let's say. That's just the way that was going. It's quite interesting. I found a letter from his brother that was written in 1944 to my grandmother. And in the letter there, his brother, Leonard's brother, is expressing to my grandmother how it's so wrong that they're taking men with families when there are still plenty of young, single men back home that can do the fighting. And then he goes on to say that this is no place for a married man to be. He could not explain where he was at the time, but I did ascertain from the letter and the timing, what have you. He was actually on a ship at that time. He was on a ship in the Pacific, probably heading towards Saipan for the invasion of Saipan. So that was I've kind of put those things together from the timeline as to what was happening with him at the time. Anyway, so it was it was a communication there that, you know, here's this guy, you know, he's got a family and kids here, you know, and he's drafted to go do his part. So lo and behold, yes, sir, he went in, went in through Camp Blanding, was inducted there. I guess they went to a battery of testing at that point in time. My grandfather scored very high on the testing, which put him into a brand spanking new program that was underway at that time, which is one that ultimately, I would say, won the war or ended the war anyhow. And the program that he was put into was the B-29 bombing program. So he was trained as a B-29 tail gunner.
And for our listeners, the B-29 is the same aircraft that actually carried the atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Exactly. Yes, sir. Yes. And that's the reason I state it's what ended the war. That plane was the delivery system for the atomic bombs that ultimately, one would say, ended the war. However, in what I'm going to tell you today, you might have a little different thought and pattern of just what did end this war. Okay, so anyway, ultimately, yes, it was all troops together and America's perseverance that won the war. Then the B-29 program is put into place. I say it's put into place. It's at its infancy. So the B-29s are being built as the men were being trained. My grandfather's flight records indicate that he was on the B-29 program is beginning. They're building the B-29s and the crews are being trained. When my grandfather was inducted, the training that he received was to become part of a replacement crew for the B-29s. Now, of course, when he first went in, they didn't realize what would be happening. But what happened with the B-29 program was, as it moved along, the B-29s were being shot down more frequently than, let's say, they could keep up with to keep more planes coming in. They developed replacement crews, and the replacement crews that were coming in, well, they were trained, what's described by some as very well and by others as kind of hastily. So it depends on which side you look at it from, I guess. Ultimately, though, the men are trained inducted in 43. So November of 43 induction. So goes through training through of 44. And all of 44, he spends time in Texas doing his gunnery work. They do practice flights on mostly B-17s because the B-29s were not available for training. So there were a few B-29s available for training out of Peyote, Texas. ultimately, before they were shipped over to the Pacific, they would make a single flight from Texas to Havana, Cuba, and back, and that would represent their long flight over water that they would be resembling over there in the Pacific. So they went through this process through their training. He's trained as a gunner for the tail. The B-29 is the first airplane equipped with computers at this point in time. In 1944, they're computerizing the gunnery system on these particular planes. So the guns were set up on the planes, the 50 caliber guns on the bubbles underneath and the tail and on top. They were controlled by a computer system that would enable the gunner to turn his head essentially, and where his head was, where his vision was, is where the gun would then, the turret would turn to, and it would focus in on a sight and then fire when it was ready to be fired. The guns could be fired by a single point in the aircraft, the CFC gunner, central fire control. He could control all guns, or he could give a gun to any one of the other gunners to operate at any time. It's really, really fascinating stuff that they're getting into, cutting edge equipment. You know, like I say, computers on the planes in 1944. It's like, we're like, huh?
yeah, that's something I never even knew. That's pretty cool.
The B-29 program is fascinating. There are approximately 3,100 B-29s built in total throughout the entire program. So a little more information on the B-29 program is, you know, it's one of these typical deals where the military said, okay, we need them, and the contract was let, and the planes were not delivered on time. And then when things started to be delivered, essentially, with these particular planes, they were kind of manufacturing them and sending them into battle at the same time, if you will. So they're learning and doing things as the planes are going along. From the time my grandfather got on a plane, February 14th of 1945. He got on a B-29. It was a brand new B-29. They just manufactured. He and the crew that he was with got on that B-29 in Kansas. They then flew to Mather Field, California, which is just north of San Francisco. From Mather, they made a trek to Hawaii, and then a second island. I forgot the name of it right now. And then to the point that they were based at, which was Saipan Island. So on February 25th, 1945, the LAW crew with the 11-man crew on the B-29, which consisted of gunners, a bombardier, an engineer, a pilot, a co-pilot, and 11-man crew, they all arrived there in Saipan as a replacement crew. The island of Saipan, I don't know how much I should share with you here. But anyway, so the island of Saipan was set up as a base. And over the summer of 1944, the Marines took Saipan. It was then turned into a base that the B-29s could operate from. Saipan Island, Tinian Island, and Guam are all in a general area. Those three islands would house the B-29 bombing program from November 1944 forward. So that's where the B-29s were stationed at that point. Here we are, February 1945, 25 of February, the men arrived at Saipan Island. Saipan Island was still had combatants on it. There were still Japanese soldiers fighting at that time. The CBs had constructed runways. They had a tent city set up. Things were progressing. By the time my grandfather got there, they had started to have Quonset huts built. They came as, my grandfather's crew came as a replacement crew. They were there for 5 days and then were put on a mission as observers, essentially, to go to Tokyo on a mission that was flown on the 4th of March, 1945. So his first mission is to Tokyo, March 4th, 1945. The plane he was on to go on that mission had mechanical problems within 30 minutes of reaching their initial point. So in the initial point, the IP point is where the planes focus on, and then they go in for their raid from that point, their bombing mission from there. He's on this plane essentially just to get broken in. Total flight time from Saipan to Tokyo back to Saipan is somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 hours. So the crew is able to get as far as almost to Tokyo, had mechanical problems, had to turn the plane around and go back to Saipan, dropping the bombs at any given point along the way, and then getting back to Saipan. Now, that was an experience that he went through and had to endure, what have you. What's interesting about that is there were quotas. The crews were required quotas before they'd be shipped back home. At that time, I don't know what the number was for the quota, but ultimately, toward the latter part of the war, it became 35. So you had to do 35 combat missions in order to be let loose and be sent home. So anyway, so number one mission, my grandfather goes on, they got turned around, sent back. Because they didn't make the bombing run, they don't get credit for that mission. So from there, is quite interesting because General LeMay is now taking over the forces for the B-29 program. The B-29 is an aircraft that was designed to fly at high altitude to avoid anti-aircraft and to drop bombs from about 30,000 feet.
That's a pretty high bombing ground.
Yes, sir. And what that was out of the anti-aircraft reach of the Japanese. So, you know, it's the way to go. Makes a lot of sense. Okay. Problem that was found out with that is when you drop bombs from such a high height, it enters a stream of air that makes all of your calculations from point A where the plane to point B, the ground, suddenly nothing works because the bombs get swan all over the place and they miss their targets. So the B-29 program is having a hell of a time hitting its target. When LeMay came in and opted to, LeMay came in and said, if we cannot hit the targets from 20,000, 30,000 feet, then we're going to bring the bombing run down in elevation. So what they did is they came and they did a few test things where they brought the planes down a little bit lower, and they saw that there was success. So what then LeMay decided to do was to launch the most horrific firebombing that's ever taken place, and that would be March 9th, 1945. And the pre-flight conditions were that you'll fly in between 7 to 8,000 feet and drop your bombs on Tokyo. That was the plan. Also, part of the plan was you wouldn't carry extra ammunition or guns because we're making more room for more bombs. So now the whole planning, the whole B-29 program, the premise of it is now everything these guys practiced for the bit of training they did have, now is no longer, doesn't apply anymore. And we're not high level. We're not flying pressurized. We're not dropping bombs from high altitudes. We're down so close to the ground, you can almost be hit by a small arms fire, you know? So this was the command, and this is what they did. LeMay sent those guys in there with incendiary bombs on March 9th, and they came back without one loss of B-29 after setting ablaze 16 square miles of Tokyo.
Oh, wow.
The estimated loss of life is somewhere between 80 and 120,000 people in one night. Here we are, the bartender family man from Orlando, Florida, Canadian born, 26 years old, is now in this arena, this area, this venue, if you will, to what would happen for the next month from the islands of Tinian, Saipan, and Guam. and what is described as the firebombing of Japan, or the fire blitz of March. So during that time frame, the 21st Air Force 500 Bomber Group, all the bomber groups involved down there in the islands, they attacked Osaka, Tokyo, Nagoya, Kobe. Those cities, they pelted on five separate occasions through the month of March that essentially brought the Japanese to a point that it was pretty obvious that they were going to have a significant problem from this point forward with what was going on. So that takes us through the month of March. Easter morning is April 1st, 1945. My grandfather and the law crew get onto a B-29 serial number 4469666. It's described as the Z-11. So the mission is to go to Tokyo, back to Tokyo again, target number 357, which is a story in itself. Target number 357 was the most heavily guarded aircraft manufacturing plant in all of Japan. It had anti-aircraft batteries set up all around it because of what its importance was. As a matter of fact, it took 13 missions to that bomb, to that factory before it was actually destroyed. And I believe the date it was destroyed was August 8th of 45. So just toward the end of the war. So they're Easter morning, they board the plane, they on their way to Tokyo. They are hit by significant flak. The Japanese were operating something called a Baka rocket. And the Baka suicide rocket was essentially a man would guide a rocket that was dropped from an airplane. So they drop the rocket, they ignite the engine, a man steers the rocket into its target and explodes. So it's a suicide rocket, was believed to have hit, well, first of all, the plane was hit in the wing, and it started a fire there in the right wing, and then it took another hit in the fuselage by flak. And then the Baka rocket came in underneath them, exploded, and that took the plane into a condition that the pilot, Lieutenant Law, or AC, Lieutenant Law, he gave the command for the crew to abandon the ship.
Now, that rocket that you're talking about, what's interesting is they had the same thing on submarines where they were using them as torpedoes, man-guided torpedoes.
It's
crazy.
It.
It's crazy that what they came up with to try to counter us making the mainland of Japan.
The whole invasion plan is oh my god, it's a good thing America didn't have to experience that, I think, or the rest of the world either, for that matter. Yeah.
So his aircraft was then hit, and Lieutenant Log, the
aircraft is hit. Yep. There was trouble up front, is the report that was written. I'll give you just the move ahead here quickly. One of the crew members survives the war. So we have significant information from one of the crew members. He survived the war. Okay. So there was trouble up in front. They couldn't get out for some reason. Oh, they couldn't get back because of the fire. So they had to go out through the front landing gear. They had to crank it down by hand because the electronics were gone. So the guys up front were able to get out. So Lieutenant Law died in the plane when it exploded. At this point, the 10 men that survived the crash are on the ground near Tokyo. We have one survivor. One of the crew survived the war. His name was Raymond Hopper. So we have some good detail from his accounts. All the men were taken as prisoner and taken to what's called the Kempeitai headquarters in Tokyo. I don't have any description of the other men's capture, but Raymond Hopper's capture is described by himself as being going something like this. He sought shelter off the side of the road, heard some voices, and then he left the area that he sought shelter. While crossing a rice paddy, he was seen by several villagers, and they began to head toward him. At the same time, a man with a black suit on came through the crowd, came over to where Hopper was, took his .45 pistol from him. And he had, Hopper had put his hands up. The soldier took the .45 pistol from him, fired two shots in the air. His description was that he felt the next shot would be for him. Then his hands were put behind his back, and he was taken out of the rice paddy. As they were walking out to get to a truck, the villagers began to attack him. He got kicked a few times and pinched real bad by the folks, and he was treated pretty rough there. So taken captive. He also was taken to the Kempe Thai headquarters, where he saw and was in a similar cell to where my grandfather was. Kempe Thai was located, from what I understand, just within a few hundred feet of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. The men were kept there for a period of time, interrogated, held as war criminals, essentially, while they were waiting for their trials. From there, Raymond Hopper, he, in a letter he wrote to my grandmother, explained that the last time he saw the crew was around April 16th, as they were put onto a truck. From there, it is presumed that the men were transported to Tokyo Military Prison in Tokyo, Japan. The prison that they were sent to was an actual military prison for the Japanese. They held Japanese prisoners, dissidents and what have you, in this prison. There were about 400 prisoners, Japanese prisoners, in the prison that men were sent to. So my grandfather, along with the rest of the crew, is sent to this Tokyo military prison. That was around mid to the latter part of April. From that time until May 26th, they were joined by a number of other Americans, totaling at this time now approximately 62 to 65 American B-29 airmen were taken to the Tokyo military prison approximately April 16th toward the latter part of April. Raymond Hopper was taken to a moray. It was another POW camp called a moray in Japan near Tokyo. He was taken to that prison camp, put in solitary confinement. Basically, I understand he was in a box for several months, and that's how he finished out the war at that POW camp. Back to my grandfather and the rest of the men, they're at the Tokyo military prison in Tokyo, Japan. Between the time that they're brought there up until May 25th, thereabout, a number of other American B-29 airmen are also brought there.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
No one else gets these rewards.
Sergeant, that is just plain untrue.
What in tarnation?
Sir, PenFed's PowerCash Rewards Card isn't just for military members. Anyone can get cash back on all purchases.
Ah, figgins! You've ruined my favorite song.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/PowerCash. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
My first plan to spice up the NFL season was to add man-eating tigers to the game. We lost a lot of great players that day, and that was my bad. Now I'm bringing you the Caesars Sportsbook app. It's got live in-game betting, parlays, and Caesars rewards, people. It's even better than Tiger Ball.
Must be 18. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700.
totaling approximately 62 to 65 airmen at this point in time. They're all held in what's called cell block number 4. The Japanese command, September of 44, had determined that they would need more prison space and they were going to put prisoners in different places. And this is one of the accommodations they made at this particular prison that was that held primarily Japanese prisoners. So there's about 62, 65 American airmen in cell block number 4. From that point, May 23rd, bombers came in over Tokyo and they had bombed a significant area of Tokyo, hitting the a portion of the prison at that time and started a fire in it. That fire was put out and it was dealt with. On May 26th, there was a bombing over Tokyo. Approximately 500 B-29s came in over Tokyo, and over the span of about a three-hour bombing campaign coming into the city from different directions at different times, a firestorm was created in the Tokyo prison area, one so intense that essentially the neighborhoods, people's homes, the prison itself was engulfed in flames. It's described as everything that was wood was burnt. So everything, I mean, even the handles of shovels and picks or what have you. So what took place on the 26th was this: as the bombs were coming in, the alarms went off around 11 o'clock at night. People formulated what they were doing, what they had to do to fight fires. They had this program set up in the prison. They had prisoners within the prison that would fight fires and they would do firework. Well, because of the bombing that happened on the 23rd, that caused so much havoc, the prison was shorthanded on the 26th. I understand they had 11 official prison guards on hand. So the prison is shorthanded. So as the prison was being hit with bombs and what have you, the guards were ordered to move the prisoners out of the prison to the safe area. So all the Japanese prisoners were evacuated from the prison site. The American prisoners were still held in cell block 4 as fires are raging and bombs are falling. The commandant of the prison made previous statements that he didn't care what happened to the prisoners, and if the prisoners were to get out at any time, that it might be okay to kill them. So this was the way that the mindset was in the prison area. Now, if you put yourself in perspective here, on the 23rd, the bombing was so intense that a lot of these guards lost their families, lost their homes. They're pretty enraged, and they're understaffed on the 11th. So the bombing's taking place on the 26th. They were able to get the Japanese out. The American cells were put on what's called half lock, which would enable you to basically flick a lever and then the prisoners could get out. It was determined that there would not be adequate support for the Americans to be brought out and put into a safe site because they didn't have guards to do it. So ultimately what happened was one of the bombs did hit cell block number 4.
For over 30 years, you've connected to your family history with Ancestry. Our expansive record collections and growing network of family trees have helped our members make billions of meaningful connections. Those are more than names and dates. They're relatives, homes, hardships, and triumphs that all become part of the rich stories we share. While you're connecting to your family, we're working to make your discoveries easier and more rewarding. We're evolving how DNA shows who you're connected to. We're simplifying the ways you keep track of family, old and new. And we're helping to fuel your breakthroughs by always listening to you, improving everything we do to serve you better. Because your family's story has always been our priority. Imagine what's possible when we connect it all together.
as the Americans are locked up in there. A commotion starts. Some of them are able to get out. About half of the prisoners are able to get out of cell block 4 and make their way toward what they thought would be a safe area. But as they're brought into the prison, they're blindfolded, so they have no idea where they are. They have nobody speaks English, so nobody can understand how to get to a different place. And it's this fire raging everywhere. Commandant of the prison was heard to say, "Don't let them escape, kill them." And at that time, a couple of the guards took it upon themselves to enact that order and kill some of the men with swords as they were heading toward the escape area. Ultimately, what happened there that night on May 26th, destroyed the prison, and the heinous acts that took place and inactions that took place, the 62 American airmen were also killed. So the following morning, about 6 a.m., some people start moving back into the prison. Bodies are observed from that moment forward. An order is given to get rid of the bodies. So the American bodies are now put into what was a half-dug bomb shelter. Bodies are essentially, we're just going to use the term, dumped into this area. Dirt and debris thrown over them. That's what happened there that particular night. From there, the story moves forward. We know what happened with the war. The B-29 continues to bomb Japan. I read an account from a particular prisoner that was in another area of Tokyo that he was extremely puzzled by the month of June. The month of June, nothing happened. And all of the area there, it's like nothing happened, just went silent. And he found out after the war, what had actually taken place was every target that was worth bombing in the Tokyo area had been destroyed at that point. So they weren't focusing there anymore. They were focusing things more toward the south at that point, the bombing campaign was, which is also quite interesting. So as the war moved forward, the B-29 steps up, carries the atomic bombs. War comes to end. Now, at the end of the war, there's the massive things that take place there with graves registration and identifying the dead. America now at that time has suffered more than 400,000 casualties, of which approximately 72 or so thousand are unidentified, of which approximately 30,000 are unidentified remains that are in the Japanese Philippine area on land. Those 62 American soldiers that are in the hole in the ground now in February of 1946, an exhumation team comes in and they are aware of what's taking place and they start removing the bodies that are in the mass grave on the prison site. So that work determines that there are 62 bodies. It also stated, the report states that some 30 some skulls are missing. It also, in the report, states that the majority of the femur bones are broken or fractured. And there's debris and there's wire and there's other things in the gravesite area as well. And some very, very little fabric. So everything had been burnt. So there's one Japanese T-shirt, they said, in there. That's how things were found there. During also what's happening now as the exhumation is going on is a war crimes prosecution team is beginning their work. And what ultimately happens here is there is a war crimes tribunal that takes place, and the case number is described as Yokohama T-078. And that war crimes tribunal relates to case number 111, which is described as the Tokyo prison fire. So the what took place there that night turns into a war crimes tribunal. Five men ultimately are convicted, miscellaneous acts of insubordination by some through murder, different different accounts and then deal with all of this information that I'm describing to you and all the documentation of this war crimes trial will be available on Google Docs at tokyoprisonfire@gmail.com. Anyway, that's what took place with my grandfather's service up to the very end that he was killed, murdered, in whatever way we might see through this horrific action. His body was placed in a grave. Now, the trial that took place stated that there are 45 identified soldiers there and another 17 unidentified. So my grandfather falls into one of the 17 unidentifieds. All the information that I've just given to you about my grandfather from his birth to this very end and this war crimes tribunal was completely and totally unbeknownst to me my entire life. I never knew that my grandfather existed as when I was a child. Nothing was ever spoken of him. My mother and his children, my uncles, they knew nothing of him either. The reason this was is because my grandmother, after Leonard not returning from his service, she closed up their entire relationship into a box of photographs, documents, everything that she had relating to him and them and their pre-war life was put into a box and put into storage. No one ever spoke of him. My grandmother remarried. I did have a grandfather that I thought was my grandfather. It turns out he was not. Anyway, it turns out, for all practical purposes, he was my grandfather, but not my true blood grandfather. My uncle had this box. My uncle that's living today, he had this box. I got into it, and I was able to get this entire story I just gave you out of that box. And of course, it doesn't stop there. Because he is an unidentified, that brought me to the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, the DPAA. You can reach them at dpaa.mil on your Google machine. So anyway, his body's unidentified. I go to them, explain my story, and they then start me on what becomes another task here, let's say, not just getting to know this man that was my grandfather through all the information that I was digging through, but also the idea that his remains may be able to be exhumed from Manila and brought back to America. The way that this is done through DNA sampling and testing now, the science is available today to evidently do this in a lot of cases, and is being done regularly. There are regular identifications happening from World War II personnel regularly from islands and other places around. What's happened here now at this stage for me as the grandson of this man is I have found myself facilitating the research and recovery of his remains. Now, because he was with 62 men in the common grave, the DPAA would like the families of all 62 men to come forward and offer DNA samples. Now, this is quite an undertaking for a fellow like myself, I got to tell you, but we are underway with the task and we are having some success thus far. We have more than 22 families on record for giving DNA samples to the DPAA at this point in time. So we are feverishly reaching out to any of these families that we're trying to reach to get them to, of course, contact DPAA and provide their DNA samples so that they, DPAA, can do their work to progress the exhumation requests to get the remaining unidentifieds back from this Tokyo prison fire from May 26th, 1945.
So what was the process that you took you know, you, I know you found out about your grandfather. You contacted the DPAA. They assigned you a case researcher from the Army Casualty Department. And then you received your case record, which on that case record listed all the names of the other POWs that were associated with your grandfather's death. What steps did you take to identify the other POW family members? You contacted a genealogist, and what other steps did you take there?
Okay. Yeah. Through the help of a genealogist, I was able to get living family relatives today of these soldiers from 75 years ago. So as that was put forth to me, I wrote letters. I started writing letter and sending letter to folks. What I've developed a newsletter that I'm sending to the families in hopes that they'll respond, contact the DPAA. So what I've done is I've started something called the Family MIA POW Research and Recovery Services. What that is just exactly what it sounds like, and that is myself reaching out to these families in an attempt to bring us all together, not back together, I can't say that, but bring us together as our family members were together at one time in this prison. All these men died together. So what I'm attempting to do is bring us all back together now and provide these samples. So anyway, the one step.
Each of us has a purpose. We are destined to do something meaningful, not only to support our loved ones, but to positively impact our communities throughout the country. What do you think a private Christian education looks like? Grand Canyon University graduates 25,000 students yearly and offers more than 225 high-quality programs across 9 colleges. Find your purpose at GCU. Visit gcu.edu.
What I'm doing is writing letters to each of them, looking on Facebook to see if I can find any of them that way. And I'm just going through the motions. This whole process is happening through me, I would say. And I am, like I say, facilitating things here, but it's almost as though there are greater powers working this, you might
right.
say. Really. We've been able to bring, like I say, the 22 to 24 DNA samples on the 62 men. I mean, that's pretty significant for less than a year's work.
Yes, it is. And has the Army Casualty assigned a genealogist to the case to support it? Do you know?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not aware of that being the case. I am planning to attend the family meeting that they'll do this March in Miami. And I plan on attending that with a litany of requests and questions. Because like I say, this is, in our particular case, this is a war crime. This is well documented. Everything that happened with these men's lives at the very end is documented to the second and minute of what was happening, when bombs were falling, how these things were happening, what the actions of the different individuals were, how the men were treated prior to it. It is well documented and well worth the read of anyone interested. I can assure you of that.
Yeah, I saw. You know, you were talking about your newsletter that you're sending out to the families. When you find the descendants' information, you send them the newsletter, and then you also have a Facebook page. Can you give us information on that Facebook page?
Absolutely. So, Quest for Repatriation, Sergeant Leonard James McNeil, not forgotten. So, Quest for Repatriation. You'll see a picture of Leonard on that on Facebook, and that has a lot of information on what this journey has been thus far with him. I'm also setting up a page here for the Family MIA POW Research Recovery Service as well as some other folks that have been extremely instrumental in what's going on here with this is the MIA Recovery Network. Those folks are great over there. Paul Axums at the DPAA. I've been working with him for this project. KT Rasdorf is a friend I have in the Maryland area, I would call her. And she's been fantastic for this project. She's been very helpful and supportive of the work and contacting DPAA.
And you went to visit the archives. Isn't that correct? You went and visited the archives and pulled a lot of documentation?
Yes. Well, yes. I found that through the investigation I was doing, I found that the physical evidence for the War Crimes Tribunal for the Yokohama T-078 is held at the archives in College Park, Maryland. So when I found that information out in the summer of 2018, I just immediately got on up there for about a week. I spent up there at the archives going through thousands of documents relating to the trial. And fascinating information, photographs, diagrams, testimony from witness testimony from the guards, from the prisoners, from an amazing amount of information that I'm able to view and see I was able to scan all this material, so I physically have the scans. Those are the things that go to the Google Doc for everyone's review. So I've gone from not knowing who this man was at all to detail instance of his last moments.
Yeah, it is incredible. It's incredible that it was a common thing, that I've saw that a lot of times when these men went off to war and died, and a lot of times the family didn't talk about it. I don't know if you could say moved on, but
yeah, that's exactly what I've found. And with contacting these families, the majority of them have said that there was not a lot of discussion about the family member that went to war and did not return. The letters I have, like I said, this box that has all these artifacts in it from my grandmother, the letters from the crew members. So when the crew went missing, MIA notices were sent to the families. So naturally, the families then began writing each other. So I have letters from the other crew members' families to my grandmother. And now that I've made contact with some of the crew members, I also have the letters that my grandmother had sent to them. They've given me a copy of those. So that's that really opens up a whole new tingly feeling on the whole concept of research when you start looking at things that way. And you see, it is a real heartbreak what these folks went through. And then to not have the closure, the families I'm talking to, very few of them know just what happened. Very few of them know about the Tokyo prison fire. They only know that their loved one, their family member, went to World War II and didn't come back. But they're finding out now. A lot of these families are very grateful to me for giving them the information, because they're able to now know what in God's name happened. And it's, as horrific as it is, knowing is very therapeutic.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, I'm talking with brothers and sisters of these men that were at that prison. So some of these people are 80 plus years old. I'm talking to, it's amazing. A lot of the grandchildren, a lot of the, nephews and nieces as well. We got musicians in this lot of people. There are just regular guys. There are career servicemen that are involved in this, lot of 62, and then there's a man that happened to be a bartender as well.
It is. They come from all walks of life.
Truly, the greatest generation. Truly, I totally support that as the reality here with this group. I mean, I really honestly believe the lives we're living today, as good as they are, is because of what them folks did in the 40s.
Is there anything that you want people to know? You know, a lot of times, you know, because I kind of do this, do the same thing that you've been doing in contacting these other families, and there's times that people think it's a scam or.
Well, yeah, I would say that if any of you or anyone out there thinks that they have a family member that may be involved from World War II MIA, get in touch with the DPAA. Talk to them. Give them the soldier's name. If you have any other information, give them the information and let them. Then they'll start the discussion with you as to whether or not there's a relationship in any way that could help with what's going on. You know, there's more than 72,000 unidentified MIAs from World War II. We said that earlier. And total is 80 some odd thousand in total. So if we look at in perspective, the World War II, the greatest generation, deserves some of our attention at this point in time.
Yeah, they do. And there's never been an active government program that's actually like they did for Korea and Vietnam, where they actually went out and tried to solicit family reference sample DNA to get it on file to make identifications. And they're just now starting to start making these World War II identifications. I think they started back in 2015, and Manila, the Manila American Cemetery, has the largest numbers of unknown service members that are buried there. And so, yeah, if you have a POW relative or an MIA relative that you might've heard about, you know, your grandparents talking about, check into it, check with the DPAA, and I'll actually have all the links posted in the show notes where people can click the link and take them right to the, where they need to go to find that information out.
Yeah. That's a good thing to put up. Yeah, no doubt. Put that up so the folks can see it.
Yeah, and be proactive like what you've been. You know, you're one of the first that I've talked with, it's been so proactive enough to actually put out newsletters and have that nice Facebook page put together and with all the information, and as well as your Google Drive that you're going to have all the documents on for the families.
Absolutely, yeah. For myself, you know, it is very personal, and it's also very patriotic too. I mean, I feel that this group has set our lives for the way they are today. So there's a lot of unfinished business back there from World War II. I'm in a position in my life that I can reach out to 62 families. I'm honoring these men through this process as well. You know, so that's what I'm attempting to do through my actions. You know, is to get my grandfather's remains back for the sake of my uncle. Essentially, I mean, my uncle was 3 years old, 4 years old. He watched his father walk out the door and never saw him again. But, you know, and never got to talk about him again either. So this is all the information we've gotten together on, you know, and I've given to him. And he's blown away by it, you know. But it really is bringing some significant enlightenment and closure in his latter days here, you know. I mean, he's getting to find out things about his father that he never knew before in his life. As horrible as they are, still, we're able to determine he's on Saipan, what he was doing. You know, and part of the effects that came back from Saipan was a Gillette shaving kit. And in the shaving kit were 5 bomb tags from the missions that he flew. And inscribed on each one of the bomb tags are what the mission, where they were going, what they were doing, altitude, all that stuff. I mean, man, yeah,
it
I
does.
Mean,
yeah,
geez, whiz. That is, you know, that stuff belongs in a museum, quite frankly, really. And hopefully, at some point in time, I'll be working on a docudrama that will tie it all together and make it maybe entertaining in a.
Well, Michael, I really appreciate you coming on here and telling your grandfather's story, and you know, each and every one of those men died as a hero, and hopefully we can honor their sacrifice and bring them home and get them buried under a headstone that has their own name on it. Where does the family plan on, when he's identified, where do you plan on having him interned?
Okay. Well, as I said, my uncle, so Leonard's son, his name is Melvin James McNeil. He is a vet. He served in the Navy. We have a national cemetery in Tallahassee, Florida. My uncle hasn't gone through any actions, but he suggested that he would like to get a marker there. And if he goes first, he wants to go in there. And if from that point, if I'm able to bring my grandfather back, then by all means, he needs to go there as well. So that would be been the only talk of in the event we can bring my grandfather's remains back. So then, you know, let's see if that happens. I mean, I'm game. I've had some contact from some of the other family members that have mentioned Arlington. At this point in time, it's as wrapped up as I am into it. I feel like a special monument for this crew, this group, the 62 men is definitely in order as well.
Well, I appreciate you coming on here today. For our listeners, you know, a lot of these links and information is going to be down in the show notes where you can be able to, make contact with the Defense POWMIA Accounting Agency and the Army Casualty Office to inquire about a relative of yours that might be still listed as missing in action. And I'll also have links down there to Michael's Google information where you can look at the records if you're a family member. Again, Michael, I appreciate it. And is there any last thing that you would want to bring up?
I just like to let everybody know, just don't be afraid to look into these things. And don't think it's not important. It really is. This is significant history we're looking at. And if we do not preserve it and tell these stories, they will not be told. Thank you, John. I appreciate your help.
Thank you for listening to Stories of Sacrifice, World War II, American, POW, MIAs in the Philippines. This has been a production of the U.S. POW, MIA Family Locating. You can find us on the web at uspowmiafamilylocating.com. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and given in the best intention. Overall, the POWMIA accounting community is doing what it can with limited resources. It is our hope additional federal funding will be provided, along with additional partnerships established to disinter and process the remains of our unknowns located in the national cemeteries. You can help by contacting your congressional representatives and asking that they implement a DNA lead policy for those unknown POWMIAs. Thank you for listening.
So much to explore at Total Wine and More. Pinot Noirs and Grigios, Champagnes and Chardonnays. Plus more than 2,500 beers and bourbon barrel aged. Tequila, rum, scotch and gin, vermouth that's extra dry. Hard seltzers and single malts, so many for you to try.
Now offering delivery in select markets. See details at totalwine.com/delivery. Drink responsibly, B21.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.